welcome to episode 204 of the Cricket Hair Weekly. There was no need for us to get out of bed early today, Sunday, because the test match between Australia and South Africa finished a day earlier than we were perhaps hoping it would. The winning margin in the end was an innings and 284 runs, so congratulations to Australia. That's actually the second highest winning margin ever in a women's tested, and the first and the top one was New Zealand's first ever test against England way back in 1935. So we're talking quite a big, spectacular victory, and we did have some questions come in about that that we should probably explore. The first one relating to Annabel Sutherland, who had basically, well, the match of her career so far. She's still very young. She scored a double hundred and took five wickets across South Africa's two innings. An incredible performance by her, Sid.
Yeah, player of the match performance. And, you know, I mean, you've got to hand it to her. I mean, I was one of the Annabel Sutherland sceptics, I'm not going to lie. But, you know, this test format, she's played five tests now, and this is her second hundred. And obviously she managed to knock two hundreds together there as well.
And you've got some stats about how common that is as an achievement.
I mean, there's a fair few people that have scored 200s in their test careers. But the thing with Annabel Sutherland is that she's only 22 and she's already scored two. Two current players have scored 200s in their test. Do you know who they are, Raf?
Give people a chance to think about it. So I got one, because we actually did this exercise last night.
No, you were supposed to pretend that you knew both of them, Raf.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry, I'll rewind.
I got Heather Knight pretty much straight away. So Heather Knight, I think I did say Elise Perry as well, but I wasn't 100% sure because I know that she's got a 99 as well.
Yeah, of course they are the two. But okay. So quite a few people have got two, but the number of people that have got three, and you know, Sutherland's still got quite a long time ahead of her. And if Australia continues to play a couple of tests a year, she might, the highest is five. Jan Breton in 27 tests, she got five. There's a few people on four. Ina Bakewell's got four. Claire Taylor, Tails, Debbie Hockley, Charlotte Edwards, Bessie Wilson. So a few people on fours and threes there. Betty Wilson was on a three.
Okay.
So, you know, she's definitely on course to potentially break that record and at least level that record of five.
She's just taken to the test format.
Something about, fact that she's able to bat in that format. And if they can push her up, because she was batting down the order again.
Yeah.
And she still managed to achieve this. And actually, Alyssa Healy was asked about this, wasn't she, Raf?
Yeah, she was. Because obviously, Sutherland did the same thing at Trent Bridge, kind of coming in the late middle order. And then they were saying, oh, perhaps she could get a bump up the order. But I think that she was batting in the same position as she did at Trent Bridge. Healy was asked about this after the match and kind of said, well, yeah, she probably should really be batting at two or three. But I don't know who she would displace. So a little bit of a diplomatic answer there from the Australian skipper. I think it's an interesting one because it is a very established lineup. But come on, you can't keep sending in your test centurion to bat at, you know, five or six, can you?
Yeah, and it's just, you know, test match batting is different. You know, it's a different game. And, you know, she did fantastically well again. And yeah, I think she's on course to break that record. So what about Australia more widely in this test, Raf? You know, what did they kind of get right? Because, you know, there was a chink at a point in time when it looked that even though South Africa got bowled out for nothing on the first day, there was a chink, wasn't there?
There was.
Because I actually rushed upstairs and woke Raf up.
You did, you annoying person.
So I got up to watch it and I went and woke Raf up and South Africa have been bowled out, but Australia are three down inside six overs, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, you've just got to come up. Because it looked like Australia were about to fall to pieces as well.
So I come rushing down the stairs and then
no wickets
fall for several hours. Thanks for that, Sid. I really, really needed to be woken up at 6:30 a.m. in order to watch Alyssa Healy and Beth Mooney bat for several hours.
How did they turn it around, though? What was the key to that?
I mean, sensible batting, basically. It sounds very trite and it sounds very obvious, but the thing was that once they batted together for, you know, 45 minutes, they were just inching closer and closer to that score. Because South Africa had been bowled out for only 76, it just meant that all they had to do was just dig in just for a very short amount of time. And there was no real scoreboard pressure, partly because it's a test match, but also because there wasn't really a kind of target for them to chase. It was just like, well, you know, if you bat for an hour, then you're going to overtake what South Africa have made, basically. That was kind of that. So the problem was the way that South Africa folded in the first innings. And really what we saw from South Africa in the second innings was quite a bit more fight. And if they'd been able to replicate that on day one, then, I mean, you know, lots of things would have been different. But actually, that was that first couple of hours of South Africa being bowled out for 76, that's then set the tone for the rest of the test.
Yeah, and it was something that we talked about with regard to Australia and India as well. It's about Alyssa Healy's ability to adjust her game. Because, you know, Alyssa Healy is the woman that went out and, you know, scored a whole pile of runs by going mental at the MCG in that famous match in 2020. What she was able to do here was come in and just go, you know what, you know, there's so much time left in this game. Yeah. I've got so much time that we're not chasing a realistic total. I can go at 1-2 and over for the next hour and a half, 2 hours. And it just doesn't matter. There's nothing. There's no need to push at all. And she did basically shut up shop. And, you know, her ability to be able to kind of shift her game a bit and to be able to say, I'm going to play a slightly different game. And that's what ultimately made the difference. And once, you know, Healy in particular had kind of pushed them towards, you know, a lead of like, you know, 100. And by that point, it was already going to be very difficult for South Africa to come back on it. And then, of course, what happens is Sutherland comes in.
And obviously batted very well, but by that point the South African bowlers were just knackered, weren't they? I mean, it was so hot, just unimaginably hot for us here enduring an English winter, actually a relatively mild one. But, you know, the idea of actually having to go out and play cricket all day in 45, 46 degrees is just mad. And South Africa were basically in the field for like 2.5 days or something. And then had to have after a 10-minute turnaround, then had to go back out and try to bat. So I think that after just that little first bit of digging in and then achieving parity, basically Australia massively had the upper hand, partly because they could then exploit the weather conditions in a way that suited them. Now, I'm not saying that batting and making a double hundred in that heat is easy either. That was actually an incredibly impressive feat. But poor South Africa having to be in the field for that long, right?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the teams that went out onto the field as well, because South Africa, to a certain extent, were always a little bit down because they went into the game without their best player, didn't they, Raf?
Yeah, well, we talked about this in last week's episode, and I said Marizanne Kapp will be key. I mean, it's a pretty obvious point, right? She's their best player. She's basically their best batter and their best bowler. And she, unfortunately, on the morning of the game, so right before the toss, they decided we can't risk her. Now, we don't know the exact specifics about why she was ruled out. It is well known that she's got this ongoing heart condition that does sometimes cause her to have to sit out games for the sake of her long-term health. So it may have been something to do with that. The heat may have played a role. We're not 100% sure, but whatever it was, that was obviously a huge setback for South Africa. And of course, as well, the fact that they just haven't really played very much test cricket recently. And one of the questions that we got on Twitter from Punt, as he or she is calling themselves, was, what are the learnings from South Africa from this series overall? Well, I think one of the learnings is play more tests, because otherwise it is always going to result in a mismatch when one side has played one test just this month, or just last month, and then another test a few months ago, and South Africa haven't played any for 18 months. That's just, Australia are going to be better at the format because they know how to play it. So play more tests.
Yeah, and what about, so the other thing that people have asked about is, you know, Laura Wolfart and how her form has been, and obviously, you know, another vital player to South Africa. And, you know, her form in this series has not been great, has it, Raf?
It's not been the best. No, she did have one good score in the T20 leg, I think.
Yeah, she basically won them that second T20. She got 58, I think, in that game. But other than that, it's been a string of sort of single-figure scores, and it's not been looking good. And people have been, you know, kind of asking about her captaincy. And I think we had a question about her captaincy, didn't we?
Basically saying, is her dip in form potentially related to her having to take on the captaincy? And I know you've got some...
Yeah, I think it is really interesting what's happened. And I think that, you know, we've talked a lot about captaincy and about things like succession plans. And what's really interesting is that South Africa actually did have a succession plan. And that succession plan tells us quite a lot about what's going on here. So, you know, when Mignon Duplier retired from the captaincy, and she said she wasn't going to carry on with the captaincy, they appointed Danny van Niekerk. Yeah. Definitely the right thing to do, you know, a leader and a good captain and a good cricket brain and all those positive things. And at that point, they clearly decided that Sune Luse was going to be the next South Africa captain. So Lee stood in for Danny van Niekerk on several occasions when van Niekerk was injured. And, you know, ultimately she was appointed full time when Danny van Niekerk was not going to be the captain anymore.
That's a very tactful way of putting it.
So that was their succession plan. Yeah. But the problem is that succession plan didn't really work out. And their kind of plan C was obviously Wolfart. We know their plan C was Wolfart because Wolfart actually did stand in a couple of times in 2021 when Lees and van Niekerk were both unavailable. She said she captained a couple of games in India in 2021. So she was obviously their backup plan, but the fundamental point was that she was a backup plan. The South African management knew in 2019, 2020, when they appointed Lees, the kind of long-term successor, that they didn't want Wolfart being the captain. We know they knew this because they didn't make her the vice-captain.
It's partly a kind of a comment on perhaps her personality or her kind of style of play in the sense of that she is quite a quiet, softly spoken person. You've interviewed her a couple of times.
Yeah, I've done a couple of long interviews with her, and she's very kind of thoughtful, and she's obviously a very smart person, and she's a very deep thinker. But she's quite a kind of self-absorbed in the best kind of way. But
like
she's
preoccupied with her own game.
She thinks very deeply about her own game, but that does sometimes make it difficult to think about other people's games as well. And so, you know, it probably isn't a surprise that the captaincy probably is affecting her because she wasn't expected by anybody to be the captain. If they'd expected her to be the captain, they'd have made her the successor when Danny van Niekerk was captain.
And it all happened a bit oddly as well, didn't it? At a time when there was clearly a little bit of, unease amongst the players. About potential personnel or whatever. We don't really have any insight into that, but we do know that Sune Luse kind of sort of stepped down quite suddenly and that it was all a bit tense. And Wolfart's had to kind of come in and pick up the pieces from that, and that's really hard for anybody. It's especially hard for somebody who is quite, as we say, kind of quite a quiet individual and not necessarily a big personality in that dressing room. So I think for all of those reasons, it's possible that the captaincy is really affecting her form. The trouble is, where has South Africa got to go?
Yeah, this is it. There really is nobody else. Yeah. She's the one person in that team that you go, well, she is definitely going to be playing, you know, every game where she's available for the next 10 years. There's nobody else in that team that's in that situation. Everyone else in that team is either, you know, much older or, you know, are not certainties to remain part of that team. So, you know, it's a tough one for South Africa. And I think but she does have the opportunity to grow into this. I mean, she's still quite young. So, you know, she's got time. And if if she can stick it out, then, you know, maybe long term it does turn out to be a good decision.
I mean, we talked last week about Danny van Niekerk giving that interview and saying that she was going to try and make a comeback into the South Africa team. Is this her chance to come back as a potentially specialist captain if I was the new South Africa coach?
We do believe that this time there will be a new South Africa coach the next time they go into a series. That, you know, I would be phoning up Danae and going, please.
Well, it's possible honestly, it's possible that that's already happened, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
That that's
yeah.
been the conversation, and that that's why she's given this interview, to say, okay, yeah, I've been, you know, I'll work a bit on my fitness, but I've got the cricket brain that you need. I've got the cricket smarts. And I don't know that, I mean, I'm not sure. I've not spoken to Laura Wolfart, but perhaps she would actually not mind that too much, to then just be able to go back to focusing on her own game. Another question that we had come in, Sid, after our conversations about Australia having a couple of losses in last week's episode, was actually about the forthcoming World Cup in Bangladesh. Will Australia be defeated in that World Cup? And it's going to be a really interesting time over the next few months as we kind of build towards that World Cup, and actually to see what happens in the World Cup.
Yeah, it is going to be an interesting one, definitely. I mean, you know, when was the last time, I was trying to think about, when was the last time Australia went into a World Cup or a world event? So of course, they weren't technically T20 World Cups until more recently. When was the last time Australia went into one not favourites? I think you're going back to probably 2009, the World 2020 in 2009. They might say that England were favourites because England were the current 50-over world champions at that point. Every other one, Australia have gone in as favourites. And in every other one that we've happened, you know, Australia have proved themselves either to be the best team. And when they haven't, when they've lost, it's only been because someone has produced the performance of a lifetime. So 2016, the T20, the World T20 in India, Hayley Matthews in the final produced, you know, one of the performances of a lifetime. And then 2017, you know, the Harman Monster at Derby, again, the performance of a lifetime. It took the performance of a lifetime to beat Australia for most of the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I think that that's where the change is going to come, as we've talked about. And so I think that I think Australia will still go in as favourites, but now it feels like it doesn't take the performance of a lifetime to beat them. And, you know, you'd be much more or much less surprised if someone just beats them with a reasonably ordinary, competent performance.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I think my views on this can be summed up very quickly in terms of Australia's competition for that title. You've obviously got South Africa, who were finalists last time. Well, they've been through quite a lot, even since being in that final last time around. Credit to them for getting to that final and actually being competitive in it. But it just feels like sometimes with South Africa, the foundations are still built on sand slightly. England, obviously, the other potential competitor, and India. But again, both of those teams have not been very consistent over the last year in T20 cricket. England especially are just up and down and all over the shop. And so I don't have great confidence in any of Australia's competitors either.
I feel like the best chance for either, both India and England are in exactly the same boat in the T20 World Cup. Both of them, their best chance is that the other one beats Australia in the semi-final.
Yeah, that's an interesting
chance. I wouldn't put money on either of them beating Australia in a final, but if one of them beats Australia in a semi-final, it makes the other ones really much easier.
Yeah. So I think what we're saying is it's not quite as sure a thing as it has been for the last 10 years, but it's still probably the most likely outcome that Australia win that World Cup. Let's revisit that in the months to come, Sid. Now, finally this week, Sid, there's been a bit of news an interesting piece in The Cricketer this month that sort of was not really about women's cricket, but relates to women's cricket because of Project Darwin and the fact that the first class counties are currently deciding whether to submit tenders to host these tier one women's teams in the new domestic structure. Sam Moorshead's piece is really good. It's about the kind of current state of the current financial state of county cricket in England.
Anyone that watches this for now, I love talking about the business of cricket. This what Sam Moorshead called this is a county MOT. MOT in this country is a test your car has to go through every year to make sure your car is fit to go on the road. So it was like, are the men's counties fit to go on the road? And the conclusion he comes to is that almost all of them are in grave financial trouble. And, you know, it just bears re-emphasising that, you know, every time we turn around, you know, we're seeing the men's counties in financial trouble, and we're about to ask these counties to take on a big commitment with these women's teams. And we have to ask whether most of them are really capable of meeting the kind of demands that we want them to meet in terms of being able to make those investments when they're clearly in so much trouble. And they're in trouble for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, one by another, they all have problems. Even there was the super rich Surrey. Surrey are super rich, but what we've seen in this country in the last couple of years is huge energy price inflation. The price of electricity, the price of keeping our lights on has gone up massively. That means the price of Surrey keeping their lights on has gone up massively. Surrey are going to have to pay hundreds of thousands of pounds more to their electricity supplier next year than they paid last year.
Yeah.
And that is going to make a huge dent in their ability to be profitable and their ability to be able to invest in the kind of things we want them to invest in. And this is the same across all of the counties. So obviously, you know, Worcestershire, we know that Worcestershire are out of the running for a top class county anyway, but they, you know, even Worcestershire, who have no floodlights famously because their ground always floods, so they can't put in floodlights because it would be too dangerous because the flooding obviously is an electricity hazard. But even without floodlights, you know, they're still, their electricity bills are going to go up massively as well. So it's a very, very tough environment. And Sam Moore's headpiece makes it clear how tough it's going to be for the counties to be trying to support new women's teams when they're going through this intense crisis.
Yeah, I mean, my view on that is that we need to turn it around and view it differently. They should always have been supporting women's cricket equally to men's cricket. And what they need to do is figure out what that now looks like. And actually, as you know, it probably means taking money away from the men in order to support women, because 50% of the people who live in your county are women. So you should have been doing this all along, right? Now, okay, that might mean that you can't support a team, a professional men's team in the men, you know, and it might mean that we don't have an 18 team men's county championship. Well, okay, because we can't afford that. But that doesn't, what is kind of being implied at the moment is that men's cricket can't afford to support women's cricket, right? These are men's counties, they belong to men, they support men's cricket, and they can't afford women's cricket. But that's not how we should be looking at them. We should be looking at them as counties who have to figure out a way to balance the books by equally supporting men and women. So you just need to turn the thinking on its head a little bit, I think.
Okay.
Now that's quite difficult because of all the people who currently work at those counties are like very much all about men's county cricket and Red Bull cricket in particular. And the idea of going, well, unfortunately, we might have to withdraw our team from a Red Bull competition is just like heresy. But we need to not view it as heresy, because maybe in this country we can't afford to support 18 professional men's teams anymore. And so we're saying we think we can afford to support 8 women's professional teams, so maybe we can only afford to support 8 men's professional teams.
Yeah, it's a hard question to ask in this environment, but
okay,
we ask the hard questions, I guess.
let's wrap things up there. We'd welcome any thoughts on our heretical suggestions. Please write to Cricket Her Heresy. Sid, the Women's Premier League, this year's Women's Premier League is starting on Friday. We're actually going to be recording our next episode on Thursday because you're going off on holiday skiing. So in our next episode, we will be talking all things WPL. If you have particular questions or you have particular issues you'd like us to talk about, then do let us know ahead of Thursday and we will try and incorporate that into the next episode. The other thing that we want to say is that we are now in, as well as still being on Twitter/X, we are now in the other place, as you've been calling it.
The good place.
The good place, sorry.
Blue Sky.
We are on Blue Sky. So search for Cricket Her if you are on Blue Sky. It is now open to everybody. You no longer have to have one of these exclusive invitations. Search for us on Blue Sky, find us there and follow us, because we will be posting content there as well. Otherwise, see you in a few days.
Bye.